Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
This is Up All Night, Rachel Bland with you this morning, and we're into our tech phoning, talking all things tech and gadgets now, particularly if you're having issues with them at the moment. Fevzi Turkalp from gadgetdetective.com may be able to help you out. Good morning to you, Fevzi.
Morning, Rachel.
I should say here, we've done this before, Fevzi, so I don't know if you remember that I am quite... Well, not very technologically sound. You might be helping me out with these things this morning. So if we have any complicated queries coming in, you're going to have to kind of break it down into really, really simplistic terms for me.
I'll do my best.
Is that going to be okay?
Yeah.
If you've got anything that you want to ask Fevzi, you can give us a call, 0500 909 693. Text us on 85058. The email is upallnight@bbc.co.uk. We're also at BBC 5 Live on social media. What are the kind of things that you'd like to help people out with this morning, Fevzi? Oh,
pretty much anything. If it's got a chip in it, I'll have a go.
Well, before we get on
not a deep fat fryer, by the way.
That is exactly where my mind was going. I like it that you've got my kind of handle on things already, Fevzi. Before we start taking questions and calls this morning, let's take a quick look. One item of tech news that's kind of confused me earlier this week. This is the return of the Nokia 3310 mobile phone. It was launched in the year 2000. I think we all must have had one back in the day. It's coming back, though, is it?
Yeah. So for those that don't remember it, it was a tiny sort of fat little phone with a 2.2-inch black and white pixelated screen. By no means a smartphone, but Nokia sold at the time 126 million of them, which, to put that in context, that's about double the number of iPhones that Apple sold in its first four iterations put together. So it was a hugely popular phone. Loads of advantages to it. It would have some battery life that would go several days. It was almost indestructible. It was easy to use. And it was cheap, so it was, you know, it wasn't the end of the world if you left it on, you know, on the back seat of a cab or something like that. So there was a lot to commend it.
Snake was one of the things to commend it, wasn't
it? Snake. Yes, that's right. And so Nokia obviously has gone through various machinations, and the right to produce mobile phone handsets under the Nokia name has been sold to a company called HMD Global, and they are setting about launching some of the classic Nokia phones, and this is one of them. So you know, hopefully at a little bit later this month they're going to formally announce that they're doing this, and it's not clear to me yet whether they're going to do just a straight copy of the old one or just have something that's sort of inspired by the old one.
Yeah, I mean, would there still be a demand for that? Phones have come on such a long way. Smartphones now are so different, aren't they?
Look, you know, there's two things that smartphones don't do well. One is make and receive phone calls, because they're so packed with electronics, there's no room for a decent antenna in there anymore, which is why, you know, you look at your smartphone, the antenna is normally on the outside, sort of tracing around the edges. And, you know, Steve Jobs famously said of one of the iPhones, you're holding it wrong when you tried to hold the phone and found that you were sort of attenuating the antenna signal. So there's the fact that, you know, some of the phones that are just phones actually have better signal. And then there's the battery life. I mean, if you've got a 2.2-inch black and white pixelated screen, it doesn't chew the battery.
They used to last for about 3 days, didn't they?
Yeah, no, yeah, you can go more than that. And with today's battery technology as well, if they applied a modern battery to that sort of form factor, it would go almost forever. I mean, the possibilities are immense. And those two things are important, and smartphones are not for everybody. You know, some people find smartphones, you know, confusing, difficult to use, just more than they need as well. All they want to be able to do is make and receive phone calls, maybe send and receive texts, and that's it. You know, there's a lot of people who fall into that category who don't want to spend a few hundred pounds on a phone, want to spend, you know, £50.
Yeah, it's
less.
Interesting you say that, actually. We just had a text from Richard on 85058, the phone number this morning, 0500 909 693, to speak to Fevzi. Richard says, as someone who has no interest in a smartphone, do you think the ordinary mobile will still be available as time goes on? I use an eight-year-old phone, which works fine, but it won't last forever. I just don't want to end up as one of those people addicted to their phone. That's like me, Richard.
Yeah.
I'm badly addicted.
It is interesting, you know. Yeah, when I was using Windows mobile phones, one of the good things, I mean, they're excellent smartphones, by the way, and one of the good things, in quotes, was that you didn't have this plethora of apps available for you. You had the basic apps available, and you'd use some of those, but it didn't have everything, and therefore I wasn't constantly doing what I do these days, which is downloading another app, trying for that sort of app nirvana of having the sort of the best possible mix of apps on my phone, and that's very time consuming. In answer to your question, will they always be available? I think they'll be available for the foreseeable future, but you're starting to get into niche markets. So you've got companies, for example, like Doro, D-O-R-O. They specialize in making handsets that are easy to use, either for older people or in some cases, people with sight problems and so forth, but predominantly for people who aren't interested in that sort of thing. And they make them as easy as possible to use. And they tend to assume an older user, I have to say. So then what they do is put in extra bits and pieces like, fall detection. Although you may find that it's an easy phone to use and simple in its functions, it may offer a set of background features that are still very advanced, and things like health monitoring, detecting if a person has fallen and then giving their GPS location. That sort of thing is quite sophisticated. You wouldn't find that in a 17-year-old phone, but it will still have that sort of what they call a candy bar design, not a non-smartphone design.
Yeah, another question here about the Nokia 3310. This is from a different Richard. What is it with Richards and old phones? Richard says, I have an original Nokia 3310. Can I change it so it will work on existing digital?
No, because one of the things that it won't do is give you sort of 3G or 4G, that sort of thing. And, again, it doesn't give you, full access to the internet or anything like that. So, no, it is what it is. I've got a retro phone, which I think you can still buy from Binatone. It's called the Brick. And it's literally
what we all called our phones back in the day, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it's bigger than a house brick. And
really?
It's got an aerial that sticks out about 5 inches. And it takes a normal SIM and it will work as a normal phone, or actually it doubles as a Bluetooth speaker. And you can buy those, I think you could buy those for about £20. And they were kind of retro fun. It's good to give someone. And it actually works. It's got a nice big
speaker. Does its job.
Well, it's got a nice big speaker on it as well. It's funny how certain things improve, certain qualities improve with size. You can imagine a large phone has a larger speaker, tends to sound a lot better than some of these tinny jobs. Same issue, by the way, with flat screen TVs. The thinner the TV has become, the worse the speakers have been. And that's why you get people buying these sort of speaker bars that go underneath TV sets or attaching external speakers to them, because the internal ones are often so poor now.
Yeah, as the technology gets better, it doesn't sort of improve everything, does it?
No.
Fevzi Turk out with us this morning for our tech phone-in. Any questions you have on tech and gadgets, Fevzi will try and answer them for you. You can give us a call on 0500 909 693. Text is 85058. The email, upallnight@bbc.co.uk. And we're at BBC 5 Live on social media. So not just talking about telephones this morning. Gary in Glasgow has this query for you, Fevzi. He says, my wife was given a Crossley turntable with built-in speakers for Christmas and it works fine. The sound quality isn't too good, though. My daughter was given Bose SoundTouch 10 wireless speaker for Christmas. She's equally pleased. I thought I'd connect them both via an auxiliary cable to produce better sound for the turntable. But when I do so, the turntable refuses to work. It doesn't turn or rotate or respond in any way at all. It's as if by connecting the auxiliary cable, it turns off the turntable, although it's clearly still turned on because the power light is on. Any ideas, says Gary?
I wonder if that's a true auxiliary output, if that's what it's designed to do. If it's a true auxiliary output and it's a turntable, then the only thing it could be outputting, if does this particular Crossley speaker, does it do anything else, such as does it have a radio built in, for example? If it doesn't have any other source of music other than the needle on the turntable, then that would tend to suggest either a fault with the device or possibly a fault with the cable. If the cable is incorrectly wired, it may be shorting something as it connects. So I suppose you could try a different cable, and also try and work out if it happens just when the cable is plugged in or when there's something else then plugged in at the other end. Try and, you know, by process of elimination, try to work out where the issue lies. But if it's only got one source of sound, that's the platter, as it were, and when you connect a cable, then it switches off, then that would tend to suggest a hardware fault, either with the cable or more likely with the turntable itself.
Okay, hope that helps you, Gary, in Glasgow. Let's go to the phones now. We've got Nigel in East Sussex. We're this morning to you, Nigel.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You've got a question about your hi-fi, haven't you?
Yeah, Nigel. Morning, Febsy. Hi. I've got a hi-fi. It's one of these micro things. It's got a CD player on it, digital radio, all that kind of stuff. But it's also got a USB port, one of the large USB ports on the front, which the blurb says that I'm allowed, that you can plug in your MP3 player in to play it through the hi-fi. What I'd like to know is that USB port an input as well as an output, and if it is an output, if I can record my vinyl through that port onto my laptop, and if I can, what softwares would you recommend?
So what a USB port does on an audio device varies widely. So in the worst instance, they can just be there for software updates and so forth, where you download new firmware for the device, you attach it and update it. That's the most basic use. When you say it allows you to attach an MP3 player, what they normally do is allow you to attach some storage, like a USB thumb drive with MP3 files on it, where so not necessarily a sort of, it's not necessarily that you can attach a, you know, an iPod to it or something like that. It may be just that it will read certain file formats off a thumb drive that's formatted to a particular standard. Usually those are pretty basic and don't allow you the sophistication of sort of structuring your music hierarchically. In other words, you just have one bucket and you have to throw all the music in it and sort of look through it all to get to what you want, and they often don't have very good search functions. So a better way of dealing with things can be to, if you've got an auxiliary input on that device, a better way might be to use something like a Bluetooth adapter and put music in, well, either through wires in through the auxiliary input that way, from a device that plays. So you'd use something like an MP3 player.
Yeah, I've got the auxiliary input is where I've got the record player, the turntable going into.
Right. Okay. I mean, you can get sort of mini mixers or switches that allow you to go, attach more than one thing to that input. I think you're sort of more likely to be disappointed with that USB socket. It's unlikely to give you the sort of flexibility that you want, and also in terms of output, again, that would be an unusual feature, because it would mean that there'd be a digital out from there. Unlikely, because there's no standards for a lot of this stuff, you know. So you have to read the manual, you have to check it for that particular device, but my guess is that in most cases it's simply something that allows you to plug in something like a thumb drive with a bunch of MP3s on it.
I've used it to play internet radio through and that sort of thing from my phone,
it's allowed you to put a digital audio stream in from the radio into, as an input. Okay, so then that's more interesting. You need to read exactly how that one works, because it will be different on even on devices within a single brand. You'll find it's different. It shouldn't be too hard to see, just, you know, by reading the manual, as it were, whether it does allow you a digital output as well. But to be honest, my advice would be to make more full use of the auxiliary input, to go at it through that, and then have an external device that will allow you to, you know, connect different things in the way that you want. I think that's the way that I would go for it, because it's more, the nice thing about an auxiliary input is it's standard, and you can attach all sorts of things to it, and you'll know how it behaves. With the USB port, it's going to depend on, you know, how they've implemented it.
Okay, does that answer your question there, Nigel?
Yes, it does. Great. Thank you very much. Great. Appreciate that.
Thank you for calling, Nigel. 0500 909 693 is the phone number. If you'd like to speak to Fevzi this morning, he's here until 3:30. Now, Fevzi, got an email here from, doesn't say who it's from, actually. It is somebody asking, oh, it's from Sam, apparently. Sam is asking, how can I stop memory leaks/loss? How can I bring back the lost memory? It seems that memory on my C drive vanishes as time goes by. The background to this, says Sam, I haven't downloaded any serious application or films since I had 16 GB free. Now it's only 1 GB, and during usage it goes down to 20 KB, making my computer jam. I use CCleaner to bring some back, but soon they go down too. What's the answer?
Right. I mean, these are astonishingly small amounts of spare storage left. This is on a hard drive. Does he actually say what the machine is?
Doesn't know.
So, okay, so we're going to just assume that that's a Windows computer, because that's the most likely thing. So with the hard drive on a computer, be it a rotating hard drive or a more modern SSD, that drive is used in a number of ways. It's used to store all the programs that we run. It's used to store the operating system software itself, so Windows itself, the various pieces of software we run, our browsers, our word processors, our spreadsheets, whatever it is that we're running, are all stored on there. And we use it for storing our own content as well. So if we, for example, copy photos onto it, or as we produce Word files or spreadsheets or whatever, they're all stored in there. But that area that's left is not just for us to use. It's not only used by the operating system to be stored in. It's also used as a working area to store temporary files and so forth. And Windows does use something, you know, various temporary files that it needs to operate. So this hard drive is far too full, and it doesn't have the breathing space. As a rule of thumb, if you've got, you know, less than 20% of your drive available, i.e. empty, you're going to start suffering performance problems, because the hard drive, the operating system won't have hard drive space that it wants to use on the hard drive. And the difficulty with that is it just slows everything down. So the fact that you're using CCleaner, is a good clean utility. What it does is it gets rid of does a bit of spring cleaning on your hard drive and gets rid of the bits and pieces that, you know, often get left behind as you operate your computer, and that's fine. But if you're doing that and you're still finding you're teetering on a completely full drive, then either you need to transfer off some content. So if you've got your music collection or your photo collection on there, or you've got a bunch of videos on there, or, you know, those things will take up a lot of capacity.
Are those the main culprits then? Is it, 'cause I always get this problem as well. So it's the photos and the videos.
Unlikely that you'll fill it up with word processor documents and spreadsheets, because by modern standards they're very small. But you know, videos in particular, I mean, if you've got high definition videos, but almost any video will just, you know, it's quite voracious in the amount of space it chews up. Even photos, you know, as cameras have become, you know, better quality, the files that they produce for each photo tend to be larger, and certainly are large compared to the amount of space that's been indicated is left here. That drive is just altogether too full, and you just need to make some decisions. You need to either delete things off it or attach an external drive and copy off the treasured things, and you should be doing that anyway, because you need to have a couple of copies of that by way of backup. So, you know, you should be able to get some of that, you know, less used files off the main hard drive and just allow that machine to breathe a little bit. And I think, you know, it's just, Sea Cleaner's not going to do it because it's just far too full.
Yeah, I hope that helps you, Sam. Just a word then on external drives, Fabsy, because this is something that I constantly think I must back up all of my files and I haven't done it yet. I kind of presume they're out there on the cloud somewhere. And what are the sort of external drives that that we should be looking for that is an easy way to store information?
The good news is that the drives have become, you know, we mentioned chips, have become cheap as chips. They've become huge in capacity and very affordable. So you can, you know, you can buy a drive of, you know, 1 terabyte, which is like 1,000 gigabytes of data. Which is a million megabytes of data.
I mean, that should be enough for me, shouldn't it?
You know, for all but the, you know, the more ambitious users, that's more than enough to put several sort of independent copies on there. So something like that will cost a few tens of pounds, not a few hundreds of pounds. You know, the things to look at there are the capacity. Obviously, you want enough capacity. The speed. Of the device, that's to say, how fast can you save information to it, and how fast can you save information from it? So, for a conventional drive, you'd want one that rotated at 7,200 RPM as opposed to 5,400, for example, give you a faster one. And also, the way it connects to the computer, is it USB 3 compatible? So USB port is a port you often find in on the sides of a computer, but although they look the same, these little rectangular ports, the USB 3 ports are so much faster. So if you've got a computer that has a USB 3 port on it, it's quite important to make sure that the external drive that you get is also USB 3 compatible. So get a capacious drive, spend a few tens of pounds on it, and back up regularly. And the way to think about it is just think about what's on your computer today. Have a look around, you know, have a good poke around, look at the photos and the, you know, that half-written manuscript that you've been working on for 10 years. And, and often, you know, recordings and photographs that can't be replaced. And just imagine now, just for a moment, if it was all gone.
Oh, don't, you're terrifying me with this already.
But that's what we need to do. And that's also the answer to how often should I back up, is when you ask that question, well, how much of that recent stuff can I afford to lose? Am I happy?
How much will I miss it?
Yeah. But the other thing to bear in mind about this, okay, drives fail, you know, and certainly with conventional rotating hard drives, it's not a question of if they fail, it's a question of when they fail. And it's heartrending when people lose stuff that is not backed up, because often it is irreplaceable photos of, you know, loved ones and the rest of it, and things that you really want to be backing up. It's not just about failure of the drive or accidental deletion by you. It's also about the trend in malware. So people who are infecting computers with viruses and so forth are using a type of malware called ransomware, which is growing in popularity with miscreants almost exponentially. And what happens with ransomware is it secretly infects a computer. It doesn't seem to have any immediate effect, but what it's doing in the background is encrypting, that's to say scrambling file by file, every file on your hard drive, and it's locking it with a key that only it knows. And then when it's finished that process, it will then announce to you its presence and what it's done, and it will seek to extort money from you. It will blackmail you, hold you to ransom, hence ransomware, and it will cost you a few hundred pounds of ransom to have those things unlocked for you. And that's assuming that the criminals are even good to their word. And it is almost impossible, pretty much impossible, to recover from that unless you've already backed up all those files and onto a separate drive and disconnected that drive. So at the point when, you know, the ransomware struck, it couldn't access that external drive because it wasn't connected. So you mentioned cloud backup. That's also a good way, but some things are best not loaded into the cloud. You know, there's some things which, you know, is fine, but other things, if they're of a very private nature, just be aware that what we call the cloud is actually a computer server probably sitting in the United States, where it's prone to access by governments. It's prone to being hacked. And we had that with, Apple's iCloud, that people didn't realize very often that every time they took a snap on their iPhone, that it was sending a copy up into the Apple's iCloud. And some very private photos got hacked and published. So, you know, it can be a great way to back up because it has the benefit of being off-site. One of the things that you have to, with backup, that you need to be aware of is that you should have one copy locally, i.e., you know, on a drive next to you, as it were. But just imagine about what the risks are if you had a fire or if you had a theft. Might the fire destroy or might the thief steal the backup drive that's sitting right next to the computer? So
you've got to have a backup somewhere else.
You have
as well.
To have more than one backup. One backup.
Oh, my system is really, really inadequate.
Yeah,
Fancy.
One backup is not a backup. And you know what you can do? I mean, because you can encrypt these. So just, you know, we talked about how ransomware can encrypt. That's to say, scramble files so other people can't read it. You can make an encrypted backup, which is not difficult to do. Once in a while on an external drive and take it to a trusted family member or someone who will just stow that drive at a different address for you. Because it's encrypted, if it's stolen, they shouldn't be able to hack into those files. But it just means that if there was a break-in or fire damage or even water damage, that you know, you can still go back to that. So for those that don't want to entrust it to the cloud or want to be belt and braces about it, an off-site backup is also useful.
Good advice. Thank you, Feb. So you've terrified me into action. That's top of my to-do list this weekend.
Sorry,
now is buy an external drive, or perhaps two.
Because every week I deal with people who've lost stuff, and it really is sad.
It's awful, isn't it?
It is awful. And you know, there's that horrible sinking feeling when you realise it's gone.
Our gadget of the week. What is it?
Okay, it's so you've heard of the thing called the Internet of Things, where the objects that live in our homes and do various functions are traditionally dumb. They're now being internet connected and providing us with new functionality. And you know, we hear about internet fridges and internet toasters and you know, lights being able to be controlled via the internet. But there is another device that I've quite enjoyed. It's called a Parrot Pot. So Parrot is a company, and they're a company probably better known for the drones that they make, the little remote control sort of quadcopters. This is a plant pot. It's an internet-connected plant pot.
Okay.
And it's quite smart. It's got a range of sensors built into it. So it's got soil moisture sensor, so it can tell when the soil is dry. It's got a fertilizer level sensor to see when the soil is depleted. Also a light sensor to see if it's, you know, how much light sunlight it's getting. Air temperature sensor, and it's also rain and water resistant, so you can put the thing outside even though, you know, it's electronic. The nice thing about it is it's got a water tank built into it, 2.2 litres of water. So when it works out that your plant is in need of water using those various sensors, it waters the plant for you. It's also got Bluetooth, of course. What plant pot would be complete without having Bluetooth on it? So that's the ability to connect to smartphones and tablets wirelessly. So you can actually have a flower pot app running on your smartphone, and you can even be on holiday and get to know how your plant is doing. And you know, it sounds a bit sort of strange, and it's not a cheap thing. I mean, it's £130.
I was going to say, you know, it's a great idea, but £129.99, you've got to really, really love that plant.
But then think about it, you know, there are some plants that are expensive, and this sort of thing also will come down in price, but there are some things that are expensive and worth preserving and go beyond their financial value. I mean, your favourite, you know, rose bush or something like that, you know, you wouldn't want that to die, and sometimes it's not easy or secure thing to do to give someone a key to, you know, come in and water your plants whilst you're away. And 2.2 litres of water will go quite some way. You know, you might, you know, easily manage to go on a 2-week holiday before that water is depleted. I guess when it gets expensive is when you've got a lot of plants. But
yeah, you're super green fingered. Yeah. You're just going to have to pick one that you want to live while you're on holiday.
But maybe this is, you know, the beginning of it, and one day all plant pots will be made this way. I like the idea that it will not only look after your plant, but it will tell you how it's progressing, you know, remotely. So if you're if you're a bedroom gardener, you like to just check on your plant from your slumber, you can do that. And I think that there's something nice about doing that. I know it sounds a bit, I suppose it's a bit geeky, isn't it? But it's as close as, you know, we tech folk get to nature, I suppose.
You want to control everything with technology. Right, let's go to the phones. Chris in Sheffield has been patiently waiting for us this morning. Morning, Chris. You've got a question about your Nook, which is like a Kindle.
Good morning, little weed.
Yeah. Hello, guys.
Hello, Chris.
Pleased to speak to you. The problem I've got, really, is with one of the larger company stores.
Okay.
I have a Nook, N-O-O-K.
Yeah, I remember the Nooks.
Yeah, which was bought for me by my family because it was a lot cheaper than buying a Kindle.
Yes.
So it's got a larger screen and everything else. But one of these major stores decided it was going to take it over.
Yeah.
And have wiped, completely wiped, all the memory and everything else from it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if I've got a legal challenge or a sales challenge to get that program reinstated so that I can watch telly in bed, you know, away from the family because they don't like what I like and I don't like what they like. So I prefer to come to my bedroom and enjoy watching TV, which I've previously got from my Nook.
Yeah.
But this major retail outlet bought out, you know, Nook and replaced it with Kindle Fire.
Yeah, yeah, I understand. Okay, so, Chris, so with Nooks, these were a rival to Amazon's Kindle devices and primarily were used as ebook readers, although some of them were more tablet like and would allow you to do things like, you know, watching video footage and so forth, but most people's use of the Nook was for an ebook reader, and it was a platform, a standard that didn't succeed. It kind of lost out, as these things often do. You know, one format or one competitor will lose to another. And it's nearly a year now. I think it was March of last year that Nook stopped selling digital content in the UK for Nook devices. And I think we can say it's, I mean, Sainsbury's took it over, or Sainsbury's Entertainment took over the provision of you know, supporting that. But essentially what it meant was, at that point, Nook owners got dumped by Nook, and they palmed it off and you know, gave a level of support in the UK, but they stopped selling the devices. And when they stopped selling the devices and the content for those devices, you at that point you were effectively abandoned. And you know, I wouldn't so much blame Sainsbury's Entertainment for that. Nook just abandoned its users because it couldn't make money. And, you know, therein lies the problem. And then you've got a choice at that point, Chris, whether you know, continue to try to utilize the existing device because, you know, the device works, in, you know, it's not broken, but without the support. And it becomes very difficult. It's a bit like having a computer that's not supported with any new software. And, you know, we've seen lots of, you know, examples of platforms sort of dying out despite being technologically very nice, that if they're not supported with content or software, then what you can do with it is limited. As to a legal case, I'm not legally qualified, but I would doubt it, and I wouldn't think it was worth your time. You know, because I know that there were a lot of people very upset in the UK when it happened last March, but I don't think they got anywhere. So I think my suggestion would be, continue to use the device to the extent that you can still use it, you know, without the same degree of support as you had previously. If you get to the point where you really want to be able to do things that you could, you know, you can't currently do, then it might be time to get yourself another, you know, device from Amazon or one of its competitors. And the good thing is that, you know, these devices have got very cheap. So, you know, the entry-level ones can be sort of, when they're on offer, they can be £30-40, which obviously is not nothing, and particularly as you've already got one device. But with that, you will find that you can do a lot more with it. So, for example, you get things like text-to-speech. So you can get an ebook and get the Amazon device to read it to you. You know, so there are some nice features, but there's a lot to be said for being on the winning platform. You know, you just have a better experience, more consumer choice in the titles that you can buy for it and what you can do with it.
Yeah, so no easy answer for you there, Chris, I'm afraid. Let's go to Simon in Cornwall. And Simon, you've got an issue with your router.
Morning. Yeah, certainly have got an issue with the router, but I think it's probably simple. But my knowledge of gadgets is zero.
Welcome to my world, Simon.
Well, yeah, I listen to Fevzi every time he's on, and I actually understand what he's talking about, which is really rare.
It's good that one of us does. Go ahead.
Sorry?
I said it's good that one of us does.
Well, yeah. I'm sure there's more than one. When I built my house, we've got a stone down in South Cornwall called Duelven, which is incredibly sick. Mm-hmm. And it didn't dawn on me, amongst the other things we did, wiring everything up, to have more than one, whatever you'd call it, a port or whatever, for a router.
Yeah.
So we've got a reverse level house. Upstairs, during the sort of living space, wireless signal's absolutely fine and dandy. Downstairs, with all the thick rock, almost nothing. I've heard you talk in the past about the routers that the broadband companies give you, a sort of cheap rubbish type things, you know, within reason, because obviously...
I think that's paraphrasing, but that you can buy better than the ones they give you. Yeah,
basic models.
Yeah.
My question really is, one, is the most likely thing to get the signal around the house by a better quality router, or is there an alternative sort of retrofit type thing that you can do to bounce signal around?
Yeah, I mean, you've got various solutions. So you can try and... So probably just worth taking a step back and say that the router is the device that disseminates the internet signal around your home or your office. So you can either have things plugged into it using what are called Ethernet cables, or you can rely upon the Wi-Fi, which will then permeate around at least some of your home, although in this case not all of it. So that's what it does. And when you say, you know, we haven't got other ports, that depending on the type of internet that you've got, if your internet comes in over a phone line, then the advice is that you attach the router to the first socket house. So you always got that sort of limitation. You don't, just because you've got a phone socket upstairs on a sort of spur, you don't necessarily want to be using it for your router, because that will degrade the signal and the performance. Right. So that's one thing, is to make sure that the signal that's coming in to the router is what you need. Now, in terms of then disseminating that, there's different approaches or mixtures of approaches you can take. You can get a superior router which is more powerful.
Yeah.
You can get a router that can operate on different frequencies, so 2.4 gigahertz or 5 gigahertz. So some frequencies are better for getting through. Some are better for speed, some are better for distance, you know, permeation. So you could look at that, but with a sort of stone structured building, I think you're always going to have an issue. The ideal thing to do, but the least convenient thing to do, is to run a cable, at least one cable up, you know, into that area. And then what you can do is you can obviously use it in so you run a cable, so it's an Ethernet cable that plugs in to your original router. It's cleated to the skirting board. It goes all the way up the stairs or wherever it is into that room. You might have to drill a couple of holes. It's not convenient. But once it's done, and it's gold, because that's always going to be the best possible solution. And what you can then do is you can then put another Wi-Fi router at the top, at the far end, and it can create its own Wi-Fi field. So it's not that you then have to tether everything via a wire because you've run a cable. You can just set up a more local Wi-Fi, so you can have, you know, more than one Wi-Fi network, or even have them, you know, merged together. So that's one solution that will give you the best performance, and particularly if you're doing things Simon, like streaming video. So you're using it for watching TV, you know, Netflix or Amazon Prime or you know, YouTube, anything like that. That's going to give you the most solid connection. Wi-Fi is great for things like email where and a bit of web browsing where it doesn't matter if a packet gets a little bit...
Yes, predominantly, you know, the room that's struggling is an office.
Right,
so,
okay.
I mean, in essence, 9 times out of 10, it is emails and bits and bobs like that. It's not streaming TV.
Okay, so then, so that's the sort of best solution in terms of performance. That's going to give you the most reliable, highest data rates, least problems.
Yep.
Your Wi-Fi also, it's probably just worth saying also that maybe the Wi-Fi can't permeate the walls. It's also possible that it's being interfered with. So you can, for example, fiddle with the channel upon which the Wi-Fi is sent. So the channels are very slightly different frequencies within a band.
Right.
And what that means is, let's say there was another device either in your home or one of your neighbor's homes, if you're, you know, terraced, where you know it's getting interfered with. However, so you could twiddle with that, and you can do that, and it doesn't cost you anything.
Yeah, I don't know whether they can discount. We haven't got any neighbours within,
right,
sort of signal. If
okay.
You see what I mean,
it can even be things like, you know, baby monitors or decked phones. You know, the cordless phones can interfere. So, but if we need to extend the signal, then we've got a number of options. We can have devices that send the internet signal through the mains wiring. So you buy them in pairs. You plug one in near your router. And have an Ethernet cable that goes into that. It sends it through the domestic wiring, and out it pops at the other end. And again, you can either have a wired connection or wireless connection. You can buy those for a few tens of pounds for a pair. They don't always work because it depends on how your house is wired. And the only real way to know is to buy a pair and try it. So if you do that, buy it, you know, online, for example, where you've got the right to return it within a certain number of days. So not just if it's faulty, but if it doesn't work in your particular home. So that's one thing you can do. The other thing you can do, if you want to just stay in the wireless domain, is you can buy a Wi-Fi router, a booster that sits about halfway between the router and where you want the Wi-Fi signal to be. And basically it picks up the signal. It's like Chinese whispers. It listens and then passes it on,
right?
But it passes it on louder. so the device at the far end of the house which is having trouble can then access it wirelessly.
Right.
So, you know, those are the sorts of options that you've got: the ability to use these devices in pairs, try and send it through the mains wiring. Be aware that those things tend to produce a lot of radio frequency interference, and then themselves could they're not as good as a wire, first of all, as a you know, because you're piggybacking on an electrical wiring, but they tend to produce a lot of interference themselves, which can disrupt things like radios and other types of wireless devices. So just be aware of that. But that's quite a neat solution. If it works, it's almost as good as a sort of the Ethernet cable running up the skirting board.
That certainly would be the direction we're going first, because the walls are 2 feet thick.
Yeah.
Would that be the cheapest and easiest option then, Fevzi, out of those?
If it works, it's the cheapest and easiest. But it doesn't
work for
everyone.
It's more expensive for failure.
Well, good luck trying that. You've got a range of options there, Simon. Hope it works for you. Simon in Cornwall there. Let's go to Sean in Belfast now. Sean, what's your question for Fevzi?
Hey, I've got an old Philips CD player. It's an absolutely brilliant player, but it's got big speakers. And I bought a wee wireless speaker at Christmas there so that I can sit outside in the garden, hopefully, and listen to the music in the room next to it. But I'm wondering, can I connect the old CD player with some sort of wee wireless transmitter to the Bluetooth speaker, or do I need to just run a cable out to it?
So, again, cable is best. So it's always this thing about quality and reliability versus convenience. So wireless is convenient, but it doesn't always have the range and the reliability and the quality. So for example, as soon as you start trying to send it wirelessly, you're looking at compressing that sound in some sort of way. You know, if you use Bluetooth or something like that, it will be compressed audio for the most part, and the quality won't be as good. So running a cable has some real benefits. It's simple and it works and it's reliable. Beyond that, yeah, you can get things that will take the audio output from your CD player. Is it, does it connect to a separate amplifier, or does it have the amplification built into the CD unit?
The amp's built in. It's just an old analog system.
Yeah. Okay. So the CD player is plugging into a separate amp?
No. The amp is built into the CD player.
It's built in, and are the speakers built in as well?
Yes.
Okay. So it's an all-in-one player, which includes a CD, or is just a CD. Okay. So you can
get. It has a good auxiliary socket out.
Yeah.
I mean,
so you get
another speaker or new speaker.
So you can get a line. So you can take that line output, and you can connect it to, let's say, a Bluetooth wireless device, or could be another standard, and that will take the sound and it will turn it into a wireless signal, and it will broadcast it, and then your remote wireless speakers should then be able to pair. So that's to say, wirelessly attach to your speaker system. But frankly, again, I would just say you're going to spend more money doing that, and you're going to have some limitations. The range on these things isn't always great, and the reliability isn't always great. And Bluetooth in particular is fiddly. Every time, something goes wrong, it doesn't pair properly and all the rest of it. It's interesting to note that Apple in creating its latest set of wireless headphones is trying to sort of solve that problem, and has come up with a special chip to try and make Bluetooth pairing, that's to say connecting of two devices via Bluetooth, more simple and more reliable. And that's a reflection of the fact that it actually isn't very good. Bluetooth was never designed for audio. Bluetooth was designed to, on a desktop, just to not to have to connect a wire between two devices, on your desk in front of you for convenience, but it was never designed to be a way of sending audio. It's since then it's been upgraded to do that, but it isn't in its DNA, and because of that it's not always a reliable way, and even when it's reliable you don't get the full quality.
Okay. Hope that helps you there, Sean.
So would it be better than, say, about a 10 meter length of cable just and joining the two?
Yeah, I mean, but obviously be aware, if you're running the speakers out into the garden or something like that, you have to have a sort of a weatherproof cable. But yes, a cable would give you a better signal.
Sometimes the old ways are the best.